copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, welcome to this talk on the gospel and the rule of law. I hope that during the conference, if not before, you've got a reasonable handle on what the gospel is. But let me just begin with a quick definition of the rule of law. The rule of law is at its heart the idea that society should be governed through the use of general or generalizable rules which are binding on both the subject and the rulers. In the middle of the 20th century, the American legal philosopher Lon L. Fuller came up with 8 things he thought you had to do as a ruler in order to govern through rules. And Lord Bingham, a British judge, more recently came up with a slightly different list of 8 things. But at the heart of the rule of law is this idea that it is government by rules. And there are 2 competing views of government, which were distinguished in the 12th century by John of Salisbury. He described the difference between a tyrant and a prince in this way, between a tyrant and a legitimate ruler like this. The prince, the legitimate ruler, obeys the law and rules the people by its dictates, accounting himself as but their servant. So you have 2 competing views of government. One is the rule of law, the other is tyranny. Tyranny is the rule of the strong man. It's the basic idea behind the doctrines of the divine right of kings and of sovereignty. Under tyranny, might makes right. The king makes the rules but doesn't have to obey the rules. And the king represents God or the gods to his people. Under the rule of law, might serves right. The rules make the king, who has to follow the rules. And the church represents the people to God. Now, this idea of the rule of law, of kings and rulers being accountable to God rather than representing the gods, goes all the way back to the Old Testament. A consistent theme in the Old Testament is its hostility to empires. The rule of law was unknown in the ancient world. Near Eastern kings claimed to be gods. The Egyptian pharaohs did so. The Assyrian and Babylonian rulers did so. Even into New Testament times, the Greek and Roman rulers did so. In contrast, the Old Testament resonates with the declaration, Yahweh Melech, the Lord is King. From the midwives in Exodus chapter 1 who defy the instructions of the Egyptian pharaoh to drown all the baby boys, through to Daniel and his friends who refuse to bow to the overbearing pride of the Babylonian and Persian rulers. The Old Testament is consistent in cutting rulers down to size. We also see the rule of law in the Old Testament in the way in which the law of Moses works. The law of Moses is a set of clear rules understood and to be applied by the community. The law of Moses was not meant to be a sacred mystery accessible only to the priests. Instead, it was to be read by and to the people. Deuteronomy chapter 6 tells the whole people of Israel that they are to study the commandments at home and to teach them to their children. Ezra, very famously in his book, reads the law to the whole of the people. Israel was supposed to be governed by clear rules, understood and applied by the community itself. And that meant that kingship was understood as coming within a framework of law. Deuteronomy chapter 17 sets out the basic expectations on Israelite kings. It urges the king to copy out the law of Moses and to read it to himself, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites, and not to turn from the law to the right or to the left. Did you hear the 2 key ideas there? There's an idea about the importance of the ruler following the law, and also an emphasis that rulers are not to consider themselves better than their subjects, to act in accordance with the same rules that they impose on their subjects, not to look for special cases or exceptions or exemptions. And the sense of Israel's kings being accountable to God's laws was built into the psyche of the Jews by confrontations between Israel's prophets and Israel's kings. Let me just mention three out of many examples that I could take. First, David was confronted by Nathan in 2 Samuel chapter 12 for having committed adultery with Bathsheba and for then having arranged for her husband Uriah to be killed. Second, the description of King Solomon's reign in 1 Kings chapter 9 to chapter 11 is an ironic commentary on how the one who was supposed to bring about the fullness of shalom in fact led Israel into a situation of injustice, forced labor, and tyrannical excess. Solomon, whose name is supposed to mean king of peace, the king of shalom, ended up with enormous wealth and military power and large numbers of wives and lots of gold and horses, but he failed to keep God's covenant and God's decrees. The message from Solomon's reign is, do not put your trust in strong leaders. They will disappoint you. Power needs to be kept accountable if it is to be exercised responsibly. Now, the third example I've chosen reveals just how countercultural the idea of the rule of law was in the ancient Near East. In 1 Kings chapter 21, we find the story of Naboth's vineyard. Ahab, king of Israel, had married Jezebel, king of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. In this mixed marriage, Jezebel worshipped Baal, and Abraham was supposed to worship Israel's God, Yahweh. The two had very different cultural understandings of kingship. The name of Jezebel's father, Ethbaal, tells she comes from a culture in which the king was a god, free to do whatever he liked. Ahab understood that as king, he was answerable to the law of Moses. In 1 Kings chapter 21, so he approaches his owner, Naboth. Naboth replies, "The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my ancestors." To grasp what is at stake in this particular transaction, we need to see things from Naboth's perspective. Naboth's family had been given the land as an inheritance when the Israelites had taken possession of the land of Canaan. This piece of land had been handed down through the generations and would be handed on by Naboth to his children, his grandchildren, and so on. Naboth knew that once the king had bought the land, it would be lost to his family forever. Naboth knew he'd been enriching himself at the expense of future generations and doing so in contravention of the law of Moses. So he refused to sell the vineyard to King Ahab. Ahab goes home and sulks. When he tells Jezebel why he is grumpy, she replies, "Is this how you act as king over Israel? Cheer up. I'll get you the vineyard of Naboth." In Jezebel's worldview, the king could do what he liked. In Israel, Yahweh was king, and rulers were accountable to God's laws. So God sent the prophet Elijah to denounce Ahab for killing Naboth and for seizing his land in defiance of the law of Moses. Ahab belatedly acknowledged that what he had done was evil and repented, tearing his clothes, putting on sackcloth and fasting. In so doing, he conceded that he was accountable to God and to God's laws. Now, in many ways, we can think about the prophets as fulfilling the function of a free press, holding Israel's kings to account. But the consistent message is that the king is answerable to God's laws. And we see throughout the Old Testament opposition to rulers who claimed absolute power. Moses decisively opposes Pharaoh's claim to be a god. Now, if you understand anything about the Egyptian pantheon, you will know that there were different Egyptian gods responsible for different aspects of the climate and the culture and agriculture and all different aspects of life. And the 10 plagues visited on Egypt were, amongst other things, A comprehensive demolition of the powers claimed by the major deities in the Egyptian pantheon. So one of the chief Egyptian deities is the sun god. And Israel's God makes it go dark. As we've already seen, Elijah denied that Ahab and Jezebel had the power to set aside the law of Moses with impunity. And in the last days of Judah, Jeremiah condemned the sons of Josiah, Shalem and Jehoiakim, for using false labor to build their palaces and for using excessive taxation to pay for them. And again, we then follow that through with the witness of Daniel, both against Nebuchadnezzar and afterwards against Darius, opposing rulers who felt that they could do what they like and could set their power up against God. Now, that Old Testament heritage sets the scene for the confrontations between Jesus and power that we see in the New Testament. Now, many of you come from countries which have had secret police or trials either conducted in secret or show trials where the outcome was already predetermined. And there are elements of all of these things in the trials of Jesus. Jesus's first trial was a secret trial which took place at night. At that first trial, the charge for which the high priest condemned Jesus was that of blasphemy. Matthew chapter 26, verse 63 says he asked Jesus, "Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." Jesus replied, "You have said so, but I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Almighty and coming on the clouds of heaven." Jesus was put to death by the Jewish priests for claiming to be God, but that would indeed be blasphemy unless it was true. But under the Old Testament law, you could not be convicted solely on your own confession. One of the accused's main protections against wrongful convictions was the requirement that any allegation should be proved by the evidence of two or more witnesses. You see this in Numbers chapter 35, verse 30, and in Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 15. So Jesus's conviction of the charge of blasphemy by the Jewish priest follows an illegal secret trial in which the rules of evidence have not been followed. But that's not the end of the story. Under Roman rule, the priest did not have authority to condemn anyone to death. Only the procurator, Pontius Pilate, could do that. And he could only do so if the person was guilty of a crime against Roman law. Blasphemy, though a crime under Jewish law, was not a crime under Roman law. So Pilate questions Jesus to see if Jesus is guilty of the crime of sedition, of organizing or encouraging violent rebellion against the emperor. He found nothing to support the charge. Jesus' answer when he's asked whether he's a king, when he says, "Yes, I am, but my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my supporters would be taking up arms," is a rejection of the charge of sedition. Desperate to find a way out, Pilate presents both Jesus and a rebel called Barabbas to the crowd and asks them which one they wanted to have released. Now, it seems likely that Pilate thought that the crowd would ask for the release of the non-violent preacher who had been so rapturously welcomed to Jerusalem less than a week earlier. When the crowd asked for Barabbas to be released and for Jesus to be crucified, Pilate pleaded with the crowd to tell him what crime Jesus had committed. Even though the crowd couldn't think of one, Pilate still condemned Jesus to death. So at the heart of the gospel stands the cross, and in the background of the cross, we are presented with a sordid picture of political maneuverings, unjust court proceedings, and abuse of power. The Christian gospel comes with anything but rose-tinted glasses when thinking about the realities of legal systems and the motivations of rulers. Jesus' crucifixion was an injustice, the only wholly innocent man being put to death, condemned for being a liar in breach of the procedural and substantive legal rules of the two most developed legal systems in the ancient world. And so on Easter Saturday, the universe holds its breath. The big question is whether God the Father will accept the verdict the world has passed on Jesus, or whether God the Father will overturn that verdict. And the bodily resurrection of Jesus on Easter Sunday morning is God the Father's decisive declaration that Jesus was indeed who he claimed to be, that he was the Son of God. In that act, God demonstrates his commitment to overturning injustice in the world, to overcoming the sinfulness of human beings, and to rescuing both the spiritual and the material world from the evil that has corrupted it. And so the early church begins its life with the inheritance of the prophet's critique of the power of rulers, and with ringing in its ears its memory of the way in which rulers have exploited law and not acted through law in order to execute Jesus. Now, although Jesus did not start a violent rebellion, he was crucified under the words King of the Jews. And from the beginning of Christianity, the rulers of the Roman Empire could see that this new faith was a challenge to their power. Lord of Lords, Son of God, Savior, all of these were political titles used by rulers in the ancient Near East. Christians applying these to Jesus and refused to apply them to the emperor. So Lord of Lords had been a title used by the Persian emperors. It was then adopted by Alexander the Great when he conquered Persia, and it was then taken over by the Roman emperors. Son of God was how the Emperor Augustus described himself when he declared that Julius Caesar, his adopted father, was a god. One of Alexander the Great's generals, Ptolemy, when he had become ruler of Egypt, he called himself Savior, Sotor. And the title continued to be used by rulers in the ancient world, both before and after the time of Jesus. So although Christianity was not political in the sense of trying to overthrow the Roman Empire, the claims that it made about Jesus as the ultimate Lord, echoing those claims about God as King in the Old Testament, was a direct and repeated challenge to the absolute power which Roman emperors claimed for themselves. Despite initial appearances, Jesus' declaration in Matthew chapter 22, verse 21, "Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's," is in fact an attack on the absolute power that Roman rulers claimed. Jesus is approached by Pharisees who want to know if he will pay the Roman taxes or not. Now, there are two things at stake in the question. One is the political question. If Jesus really is the expected Messiah who is going to liberate the Jews from Roman oppression, won't he destroy his credibility if he says he will pay the taxes? The other is religious. The Roman emperor's coins had the faces of the emperors on them, as well as declarations about the emperor's divine status. The coins were therefore blasphemous, and so, the Pharisees reasoned, paying with the coins amounted to blasphemy. Now, of course, if Jesus refused to pay the tax, the Pharisees would have reported him to the Roman authorities and hoped to have had him thrown in jail. Jesus' answer is very well known. He said, "Show me the coin used to pay the tax." So they brought him a denarius, and he asked them, "Whose image is this? And whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. So he said to them, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." The way this story is commonly misread is as a story that there are two spheres of equal size, one of which belongs to Caesar and the other of which belongs to God. Now, this sort of thinking leads us to divide our life into two. In public, we obey the laws of Caesar. In private, we follow the commands of God. But that is not what Jesus is teaching here. The real question we have to ask is, what things belong to the emperor? And the big theologians, Augustine and Aquinas, answer that the emperor only has temporary control over material things. What things belong to God? The answer is that everything belongs to God. In fact, everything belongs to Jesus. Everything depends on him, both eternal things and temporary things, both spiritual things and material things. And that understanding takes us on to the famous passage in Romans chapter 13, in which Paul is talking about the authority of rulers. And he describes the governing rulers as God's servant to do you good. That's a striking claim. A claim that the purpose of government is to serve the public good rather than to enrich the ruler and his cronies. Last year, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Hollywood star and former governor of California, was interviewed on British television. He was asked what it was like to be a politician. Schwarzenegger replied, "I wasn't a politician. I was a public servant." And he went on to explain that although he had been elected as governor of California as a member of the Republican Party, once he'd become governor of California, he saw his responsibility as being to serve all the people in the state, regardless of whether they had voted for him or not. Schwarzenegger had understood that political power is not meant to be exercised in favor of oneself or one's party, but for the benefit of the people as a whole. It's the public good, not private goods, that rulers are meant to pursue. Now, rulers, if they're wise, hope to persuade their subjects that their rule is just, or at least that it's not so unjust that it's worth defying. But rulers have always backed up their appeal by threats of force. In the final analysis, if you don't do what the rulers want you to do, your possessions, your livelihood, your liberty, and your life are at stake. Now, the Roman Empire had sought to make its rule acceptable to its subject peoples by fusing together the local religion with worship of the emperor and the Roman gods. The Jews steadfastly refused this compromise. And the early Christians did too. From Peter and John's defiance of the Sanhedrin in Acts chapter 3 and the martyrdom of Stephen in Acts chapter 7 onwards, Christians refused to obey political rulers when they sought to force people to betray their faith in the uniqueness of Christ. Now, this witness to the limits of the powers of the emperor continues into the period when Christianity has been recognized as the official religion. In 390 AD, an army commander in Thessalonica was killed in a riot. The Roman Emperor Theodosius, who'd given the Christian church many of its privileges, ordered a massacre. 7,000 inhabitants of Thessalonica were killed. When Ambrose, Bishop of Milan, heard about the massacre, he excommunicated Theodosius. Here was a Christian bishop presuming to tell a Roman emperor, the one who'd actually been responsible far more than Constantine for giving Christianity its unique constitutional position within the empire, telling this emperor that he was not welcome in the church until he had repented. And Ambrose made Theodosius do several months of repentance in public before he would open the doors of the cathedral to him. And so you have a decisive kind of continuation of the approach of the prophets to kings, now being applied by Christian bishops to an emperor, saying that the emperor was not free from accountability to anyone. And this follows through into the Middle Ages. We've already looked at the quote from John of Salisbury about the difference between a tyrant and a legitimate ruler. The timing of that quote is significant. It was written in 1159, which is before English law was first codified by King Henry II. And it was written just after the end of 18 years of civil war between King Henry II's mother and her cousin. Now, when he became king, Henry II set up the system of justice, which became the common law, and explains why England has, to this day, a different religious tradition, a different legal tradition from the one that is found in continental Europe. But Henry II is also famous in English history for another reason. Henry II appointed one of his friends, Thomas Becket, as Archbishop of Canterbury, I think hoping that would mean that Becket would follow his orders in relation to the church. But once he was appointed as archbishop, Becket proved to be unexpectedly independent. He insisted that the church had its own legitimate rights and that the powers of the king were limited. Henry II was so annoyed that his proposals and plans were constantly being blocked by Becket that he said, "Will no one rid me of that turbulent priest?" Four knights took King Henry at his word and murdered Thomas Becket in his cathedral at Canterbury. Becket's shrine became the most important place of pilgrimage in medieval England. For hundreds of years, people travelled to Canterbury to a place that reminded them that the power of the king was limited. And like the Roman Emperor Theodosius, Henry II of England was forced to do penance before he was readmitted to the church. One of Henry II's sons, Richard the Lionheart, spent most of his time on crusades, neglecting his kingdom. His youngest brother, John, plotted and schemed to become king. And once he became king, he ignored due process, existing custom, and basic principles of fairness. It's not for nothing that he's gone down in popular memory as Bad King John. Now, Thomas Aquinas, who writes a little after the time of King John, recognized that a tyrant wasn't just somebody who ignored the rules completely, but you could also be a tyrant if you ruled solely in your own interest, even if your laws met all the formal requirements. Eventually, the barons in England became so frustrated that they rebelled against King John and forced him to sign a great charter of rights and freedoms, the Magna Carta. Parts of the Magna Carta continue in force in England today, including, significantly, chapter 29, which provides that no one should be taken and imprisoned, but according to the law of the land. And chapter 1, which declares that the English church shall be free and shall have its rights undiminished and its liberties unimpaired. But 2015 was significant for another reason. It was the year of the Fourth Lateran Council. Now, on theological questions, the results of the Fourth Lateran Council were decidedly mixed. But Canon 18 prohibited priests from being involved in trial by ordeal. Now, trial by ordeal was a process in which someone's guilt or innocence were decided by putting them through some form of physical test, like holding a hot bar of iron or plunging your hand into hot water. By refusing to take part in trial by ordeal, the Christian church discredited it as a means of seeking God's will and paved the way for courtroom trials to be the way for guilt and innocence to be decided. 20 years after Magna Carta and the Fourth Lateran Council, Henry de Bracton started writing the first major commentary on English law. And he wrote there, "The king must not be under man, but under God and under the law, because the law makes the king." The basic idea of the rule of law we can see there again. Thomas Aquinas, who was writing in the middle of the 13th century, is most known today for his idea of natural law, the idea that there's a moral order given in the universe and that laws and decisions made by rulers which contradict this moral order are invalid. Now, Aquinas' idea of natural law gives teeth to the assertion that kings are accountable to God. Because natural law is given by the Creator God, it cannot be overruled by the king any more than the governor of a province could overrule a law made by the emperor. We also see the rule of law being promoted through canon law. England was the odd one out in terms of the development of its legal system. In most of Europe, the law is based on Roman law, developed and recovered in the universities from the 12th century onwards. And the church was crucial in the development of the rule of law. Monks studied the Roman texts, which had been compiled under the instruction of a Christian emperor, Justinian, and then used them to forge the church's own law, the canon law. And canon law came to form a sort of model law which rulers could adopt or adapt. And canon law has used the story of Adam and Eve in particular in ingenious ways. So if you think about the story of Adam and Eve, and you will remember how they eat the forbidden fruit, and then God comes to interrogate them. And what the canon lawyers saw in that story were all sorts of procedural rights, the right to know what the law says, what God had told them in advance, which tree they should not eat from, the right to be summoned to court, God called out to Adam and Eve, where are you? The right to know the charge against you, the right to be given the opportunity to defend yourself, the right to have the sentence against you pronounced in public, and to have the reasons for the sentence given to you. So important ideas about procedural fairness, as well as ideas about the substantive content of law, were generated by canon lawyers in the church and then used as models by many secular rulers in the Middle Ages. Now, at the end of the Middle Ages, you see a change. You see a change as centralized states are starting to produce kings who are becoming more powerful. And early modern kings in France and Spain and England and Denmark start claiming that their divine right to rule gives them absolute power. This is where the idea of sovereignty comes from. But Calvinists in France, the Netherlands, Britain insist that the king is only king so long as he obeys the law and acts for the good of the people. Things come to a head in England in the 17th century. King Charles I believes that his authority as king is unlimited. Parliament disagrees. The king refuses to back down. Parliament declares the king to be an enemy of the state and goes to war against him. Now, in the middle of the Civil War, in 1644, the Scottish theologian Samuel Rutherford publishes a book called Lex Rex, The Law is King. Now, in that book, Rutherford is making just the same point as Henry de Bracton and John of Salisbury had been making centuries earlier. Kings do not have absolute rights. The terms on which they rule are those set down in the law. Under the generalship of Oliver Cromwell, Parliament wins the war and King Charles is executed for treason. When his son Charles II returns as king in 1660, it was on terms that the king would answer to Parliament for his actions. To this day, a statue of Oliver Cromwell stands outside the Houses of Parliament in the UK as a reminder to the kings and queens of Britain that real power lies with Parliament and not with the monarchy. We owe a lot today to the early Christian martyrs and to those who died for their faith in Christ during the Middle Ages, the Reformation, and afterwards. Freedom of religion is the first freedom. Freedom of religion leads to freedom of association, freedom of speech, freedom of education, freedom of the press, freedom of marriage. These fundamental freedoms form part of the natural law, which no king has the authority to rule. Sorry, I just need to go back. The rule of law means that the law is put into practice, that subjects can know when they will be punished if they break the law, and know that others will be punished if they commit crimes against them. This leads to freedom of property, right to life and to bodily integrity, and to economic freedom. I've argued in my recent book, The End of Law, that laws can be unjust in different ways and at different levels. The fact that a society follows the rule of law does not mean that its rules will necessarily be just. What it does mean is that the same laws will be applied to everyone. And that is really important because you cannot have freedom without the rule of law. The rule of law means that laws act as a warning about what acts you are not allowed to commit and about what acts others are not allowed to commit against you. The rule of law protects the right to life and to bodily integrity, freedom of property, and economic freedom. Gary Horgan, the founder of International Justice Mission, wrote an important book called The Locust Effect. In that book, he describes how at least 500 million people in the world do not enjoy the protection from violence which the rule of law brings. And because they are not protected from violence, they are trapped in poverty. If you're a girl and you're not protected from violence on your way to and from school and while you're at school, eventually you stop going to school. If you're a farmer and you're not protected from being violently evicted from your land, you are always at risk of ending up unable to feed yourself and your family. If you are a small businessman in a town or a city and you're not protected from having to pay bribes to officials, you cannot build a sustainable business. Governments which punish wrongs effectively can open new opportunities for human flourishing, which are not there before. Data from the World Bank Institute indicates that an improvement of one standard deviation in the rule of law produces a threefold increase in incomes and a two-thirds reduction in infant mortality. To put that into context, that is the gap between Somalia and the Ivory Coast, the gap between the Ivory Coast and El Salvador, the gap between El Salvador and Italy, and the gap between Italy and the United Kingdom. So to conclude, the rule of law is an ideal. The ideal that we are governed by clear rules which apply to everyone, even the rulemakers and the rulemakers' advisors. The rule of law makes might serve right. It was not established in the West overnight. The rule of law was built on thousands of years of protest by Old Testament prophets against rulers who claimed absolute power, by the witness of martyrs who to the limits of the power of emperors, to the insistence by Christian scholars in Middle Ages that the power had to be exercised lawfully, and to the development of fundamental freedoms from the Reformation onwards. But the rule of law is something that is constantly under threat and which has to be maintained by eternal vigilance.